Hey, and welcome to Space Bottle. This is our first English episode. The podcast is made by us in the student organization Space Antenu. Here we talk about a variety of space-related topics, making them interesting and accessible for everyone. My name is Simon Sigvaldsen. I'm the host for this podcast. With me today, I have co-host Oskar Arne.
Hello.
And leader of Space Antenu, Jakob Fleischer.
Hello, everyone.
Today's guest is Vincent Kaufmann. He's a research scientist for NASA.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for visiting us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's quite a special honor to be the first international guest we've had on Space Button.
So yes.
You should feel honored.
I feel very honored. No, it's amazing to be here. Super cool that you guys are doing this, and I'm very happy to talk about my work and my experiences. And
yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, to start off, for those who don't know, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, so hey, my name is Vincent Kaufmann. I am a researcher. I study planetary atmospheres. I grew up in Europe. I'm from the Netherlands. I did my PhD in the Netherlands. I studied in Sweden for a year. And then afterwards, I ended up studying at more planetary atmospheres at NASA Goddard. So I've been at Goddard for 5.5 years now. I met my supervisor, who's now my supervisor, at a conference in Leiden, where I was doing my PhD work. We started talking about comets, and towards the end, he was like, "Hey, you know, if you ever want to do a summer project or something, let me know." And that's how I ended up there for the summer. And then afterwards, he was like, "Yo, I don't know if you have any thoughts about what you want to do after your PhD." And I was like, "I hadn't really thought about it because I started a year ago, and there's." Like towards the, so we have a 4-year PhD project in the Netherlands, and so much comes towards you at the end of the year. You know, you have stuff like those 2-3 papers to finish up. You need to do all the administration around it. So I hadn't really given it a lot of thought, but then when he offered me the job, I was like, let me think about that, because it's a big move, right? Like moving to the US.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But yeah, and then thinking about it more and just like letting it simmer a little bit, I was like, all right, let's do it. Like, I'm only going to regret it if I don't do it, right? So might as well just give it a shot. And initially, I was like, okay, well, let's see. Let's do it for 2 years, because 2 years was sort of what we agreed on, 2-3 years. And then, yeah, you know, one thing led to another. And it's like, oh, you know, maybe I'll work on this project for a little bit or that project for a little bit. And before you know it, you're like part of the system.
For how long have you worked at NASA now?
5.5 years.
5.5 years. Yep. So 2 years got extended quite a bit.
Yes. Yeah, and it's been really interesting experience. Obviously, we had the COVID pandemic, right?
Yeah,
I was there for 1.5 years. I still remember we were going to a conference, and this was March 2020. We were going to a conference in Chile, and in hindsight, it might not have been the best informed decision, because you know, like I remember sitting in the car with one of my colleagues, and he was like, "Oh, you know, this whole COVID thing is really bad because there's one case that popped up in California and it was unrelated in Washington somewhere. So, you know, we really shouldn't be going." I was like, "Well, we didn't get any official recommendation not to go, and they were really like everything is already paid for, right? So we couldn't not go." And then, you know, by the time we were there, it was it got really complicated. We had some colleagues that were. This one friend of mine, he decided to go on a 5-day hike, and the 5-day hike was sort of when all the countries started closing down around us, essentially. So I was already back home, but when he returned to the hostel, turned on his phone, and he's like, "Oh shit, I really got to get out of here now." And there were some friends that really like they barely made it over the border before everything started closing down.
Because I still remember like the day that it was announced in Norway, like. It was the 12th of March, 2020, and our former Prime Minister, Erna Solberg, who actually has been on Space Button before, did a press conference, like, basically saying we have to shut down the entire country. And 5 minutes after, there were people running around the entire faculty of, like, the university, asking everyone, just go home, go home, go home.
Wow.
Basically, so... on the way home, we stopped all to buy toilet paper because it was about to run out.
Right.
And buy groceries and get isolated.
Right. It was a really strange experience, right? But then, yeah, so 2 years of that were of my research. Essentially, we spend at home and we'd have our Monday morning calls, essentially. And then, yeah, after about 1.5, 2 years, we could go back in the office. So, yeah, I know how the experience was for you guys, but it was definitely a strange part of research. And I was very happy that I already knew the people I was working with before it started. But, I mean, obviously, it's still fortunate being a researcher where you have your computer at home, you have your work at home. You know, we were still productive. We were still keeping up with things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, how much in your line of work, how much time do you spend at NASA facilities versus research centers or other locations?
Right. So in so for my work, I work together with a couple of people that work in a laboratory. So I try and be there most days of the week. And it's really focused on NASA Goddard, which is the biggest research facility that NASA has. And I've been told lately, or like in a meeting a while back, that it's actually the largest collection of space scientists together, because I think about like 5,000 scientists working on centers. it's always amazing, because you know, you work in this one building, it's building 34, and I know
where is it?
It's in Greenbelt, Maryland.
Okay.
And there's probably like 200 people working in my building, and every now and then you go to a conference and you're like, oh, you work there? It's like, oh, you're in building 18. Yeah, never been there. And it's like, oh, you work on these things that I've been trying to figure out for a long time. And it's hard, obviously, when you have such a big faculty or big campus to keep up with everything, right? But it's cool. They do try, and you know, we get really cool talks every now and then. And you realize like, wow, we're really in the center of this, right?
How's like the culture at Goddard with like 5,000 super nerds gathered in like a tight space? Like, what kind of references do you have like internally?
The one thing that surprised me, and this was one of the reasons I liked working there, is I was there for the summer for two months, and it really felt like a university. It's a very international environment, and especially the building where we're in. So the building where we're in is like so we have planetary science, we have astrophysics. And both of those groups are just really international. We have a lot of Italians, Greek people, people from the US. But I think honestly, the people from the US probably are a minority. Like they're less than half of the people there.
Oh, really?
are US scientists. So yeah.
Okay, because I was kind of curious. Yeah, how is it being from the Netherlands and working in America?
Yeah, that is interesting, right? Because obviously you like. The Netherlands, I guess, similar to Norway, right? Like, there has always been a very strong focus culturally and, like, in terms of the news on the U.S. because the U.S. is such a prominent country in the world in terms of, like, power, in terms of culture, right? So when you get there, you think you know the country, right? You think, like, oh, you know, I've seen this on Hollywood. I know it. But it's such a diverse place. And it's still sort of challenging to me when you're like, you know, they have all these little cultural interactions.
Yeah.
Like sort of a more personal anecdote, but I've had like people that I thought we were like, oh, we're gonna be great friends, because you're like, oh yeah, we want to hang out. It's like, oh, just come by and we'll go snowshoeing or we go skiing or something. I was like, okay, well yeah, sure, but when should we do that? And they're like, yeah, you know, later. And they don't actually mean it, but they're really like, oh, you know, we should do this. And those are all those small little things where you think you understand the language, right? But you don't really understand the subtleties. We have so me and my wife, we bought a house about like 14 months ago, and as you probably can imagine, I'm not someone to keep the lawn in a very, very neat way. You know, it's like, it's a little longer than the neighbors, but who cares, right? And then it was a Friday night, 7 o'clock, and the neighbor's like, she put her lawnmower right in front of our door. It's like, hey, you guys can borrow my lawnmower if you want. She's like, oh, no, we have one, it's fine. And then Lauren, my wife, she was like, no, she wants us to do the lawn. We should do it now, because this is... So it's all these very subtle things where you think it's all fine, right? But there's really like an underlying message that you're missing there.
Very lawn-focused.
Yes, very lawn-focused. You know that, right? Like, you've seen the suburbs with the lawns and and
always very nice lawns.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sure I'm not here to talk about lawns. And
Yeah, but it's interesting to know you as a person. Like, you are Dutch of origin, but like have been Americanized in some way.
Yep.
So like, what's the biggest working culture from like Europe to the Americas, would you say?
So I think one of the most fundamental things is really how people take breaks in Europe and not in the US. So I was actually at the university yesterday, and I had lunch with a bunch of people from astrophysics, and they invited me for coffee after lunch, which is, I would say, is a very normal thing, right? Like that happens if you're but in the US, like people work behind their desk. People eat lunch behind their desk, and it's very rare that people actually like take the time to sit outside or just like take a break. And it's mostly the like the foreign visitors or the foreign nationals that actually do go out, go and have lunch. And I mean, there's definitely some people, But it, you can see that it's not inherently so much in the culture. There's much more of a, you know, you get 15 holidays a year if you're lucky, and that is, you know, that's what you got to make do. You know, it's a country where your health insurance is tied to your work, and if you can't keep your job, you don't have health insurance. If you don't have health insurance, you're in trouble, right? Because things get really expensive. So there's in a way, they're very subtle things, but they really change the work culture by quite a bit, because you just feel in a way the stress around certain people. And you know, NASA is a good environment, right? Like, clearly you're not in a very representative group of people. It's very much a bubble, but you still feel that and you still see that, right? Like, I have a friend, and he has some issue with a bone in his foot or something. And within his insurance, they're like, oh, you know, it doesn't hurt enough. We're not going to operate on it. It's like, I can't walk on this. What do you mean it doesn't hurt enough? Like, what? And it's just hard to imagine those kind of things coming for a country where, like, I don't, you know, I'm sure it's similar in Norway. I've never had to worry about healthcare. It's like, you know, I never even thought about it until I moved to the US, where I'm like, oh shit, I should really make sure that I have some kind of insurance, because otherwise I'm going to, you know, if something does happen, it's just financial ruin, right?
Yeah, Norway is quite different. The only time we worry about healthcare is like, or health insurance, is when we're traveling.
Yep.
Because we need a travel insurance in case we get put in a foreign hospital where the prices are quite astronomical.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But if we dive a bit more into your current work about spectroscopy on exoplanets, could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so that's something that I've been doing. So about 5.5 years now, right? So I started with chemistry, then I went into more the physics of ice in space. So we had ice analogs, and then when I started, Geronimo, my supervisor, he was like, "Oh, you know, I have a couple of projects you could work on. One of them is on exoplanet atmospheres, and it would be really nice to have someone sort of leading that effort." So the way that we work is we have a tool which is called the planetary spectrum generator, and the planetary spectrum generator is it's able to do any kind of spectroscopy, essentially. So you can do spectroscopy on Mars, Venus, comets, exoplanets.
But it's like a simulation.
Yes, it's a simulation tool. Yeah, and it's really beneficial if you have sort of like different people essentially leading different efforts. So he wanted someone to help out with the exoplanet part, which is what I agreed to. And yeah, so I've been working with that ever since. And it's a really interesting way of doing science, I think, because there's a lot of people that use this tool, but the tool needs a lot of backend work too. You know, there's massive databases which describe sort of like how molecules interact with light, and they need to be translated from terabytes of one thing into a few gigabytes of the other thing. And there's all these kinds of steps that need to be done as well. I mean, that's probably not the most fascinating part of science, right? But there's definitely, there's always a lot of computational stuff going on and programmatics things. So that's, we're really just trying to figure out where the next big questions lie in exoplanet research. So the NASA has been tasked by sort of an independent research board to design a telescope that will be able to characterize Earth-like planets around sun-like stars. This telescope is, they call it a flagship mission. So essentially it has a, I'm going to say unlimited budget, but it has a pretty large budget, right? Okay. So James Webb, for instance, was one of the flagship mission, or is a flagship mission. Hubble was a flagship mission, still operational. But essentially it doesn't have a strict timeline. It does have a strict timeline, but it's not a set program like a lot of the other missions. And it's really, so that allows NASA to build this telescope to really like live up to the expectations that are being set by science. And this is now currently in sort of the pre-design phase, what they call it. And the pre-design essentially like tries to figure out like what scientific and what technological capabilities do we need to be able to make that happen. So this recommendation was 25 exoplanets that are basically like the Earth, right? In terms of like a temperature, in terms of like the amount of sunlight that they get. But how do we measure that? Like, what do we need to measure that? Because that's a really faint planet compared to a lot of the other exoplanets that we've already found. So we're going to need to essentially design an instrument that is able to block out stellar light to such an extent that we can still see the reflected light from the planet, essentially, and that is over a really short separation on the sky, essentially. So yeah, and that's kind of where we're working on now. One of the efforts, and we're really just sort of trying to we have our tool, right, the planetary spectrum generator, mm-hmm. and has all the capabilities to do calculations to constrain this. But then it's a question of like, okay, well, what are the inputs and what does this mean for the required outputs, essentially? So you have to really go into all the gory details. Okay, what kind of detectors do we have? The detector translates a photon into an electron, but it doesn't do that perfectly, right? It might have a efficiency that is not 100%, or it might, it might generate noise if you do a readout of the detector. And particularly for these kinds of observations where we're thinking about like getting a photon per second from this planet, you really have to think about all the little problems that you might be able to encounter there, right? So you have to understand every little step of the way, essentially, to make sure that what we design and what we build is actually capable of doing it. Because obviously, if you spend, let's say, $4 billion on a mission, you want to make sure that the mission is actually capable of being called a success, right? Because I think NASA really learned a lot of that from the Viking missions, where they're like, oh, we're going to find life on Mars. And then, getting no for an answer, that means that the mission is a failure, right? Even though that wasn't, as a scientist, I don't think finding a flat line or not finding life is a failure. It just means that your hypothesis was wrong. But
it's still an answer.
Exactly.
Yeah. But is it technologically feasible to be able to detect Earth-like planets around other stars, given that they are so small in comparison to like the gas giants, which we can see from transit orbits or other detection methods?
Yeah, so there's what has been done for this research essentially is I think about 5 years ago. So there's the two largest NASA centers essentially got tasked to design a telescope that's able to do that. So the one is on the West Coast, it's a Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And then on the East Coast, it's NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, right? And they both came up with their own concepts. And I think the JPL concept is very neat, because what they were talking about was bringing out a sunshade, essentially. So this sunshade is a structure which is like, let's say, 100 meters large, and it flies a couple million kilometers in front of the spacecraft, and it would sit right in front of the star so that it would like physically block the stellar light, essentially. And then you could, with a small angular separation, be able to detect the Earth-like planets around this star by using that star shade, what they call it, to block out all of the stellar lights. Because the problem is you have to block out the stellar light, because you're getting about 10 to the 10 photons, so like 10 trillion photons back from the star versus one from the planet. Like there's no way you can do, like there's no detector that can get that difference, right? And there's no way that the star is stable enough to really be able to say, that one photon out of the whole pile, that one comes from the planet. So you have to block out the stellar light.
Yeah, the order of magnitude difference is just crazy and astronomical.
Yes.
Really.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so then there's essentially, that's one of the strategies. So you could use this physical starshade to just block the light. Obviously, that starshade has to move. Yeah. So they would, they did some estimations, right? So if this mission takes, let's say it's a 3-year mission, nominal mission time, there would be fuel on board the starshade. The starshade would take a couple of months to go from one star to the other. And then while the starshade is moving, essentially, you could look at other objects. There's always, we're talking about exoplanets now, but if you build a flagship mission, it should be interesting for all of the divisions of NASA. So heliophysics, galaxies, everything will be something that you want to observe with this telescope, right?
But I feel like the angular separation between like the star and the exoplanet would be so small, given that the separation is probably some proportionate astronomical units and it's several light years away, and so the angular separation would be less than an arc second probably.
So you're hitting it right on the nose here. So I didn't show it in my slides yesterday, but I've done sort of the calculations, because you're right, like you're within an arc second. So the separation between the Earth and the Sun, if you're looking away from 10 parsecs, so that's 40 light years, is the size of Pluto as we see it from the Earth. And Pluto is then 100 milliarc seconds wide. And that is the resolution that you're looking. So just imagine like you're standing on the Earth, you're looking all the way out to Pluto, and that is the separation you get between the star on the planet on the sky. And again, yeah. It's one of those numbers, like both the contrast and both the separation. It's just hard to imagine, right? It's just,
yeah. Impossible.
Yes.
It just boils down to you can't see it.
Basically, yes. But that's why we build these telescopes. And so yeah. the other strategy is, so you can do a physical star blocking technique, or you could do this instrumentally. You use interference to block out the center light from the star, and then that, based on the angular separation, you can get a really good contrast ratio. And you were asking about the technological aspect. So NASA uses this technological readiness level scale, so TRL. And there's, I think it goes from 1 to 9, essentially. And so 1 is just a concept. 2 is like, okay, you know, we've tried some things. And it goes all the way up to, okay, it's proven, it works in space, and it's operational. So there's people like making all these very complicated matrices where it's like, oh, you know, in terms of detector, we're at TRL 6, and that means that we need another 4 or 5 years to go from TRL 6 to 7 to 8, and then it's launch ready, essentially. And all of those technical aspects, they have been mapped out by these precursor studies, essentially. And that now allows us to, like, sort of plan a path forward to get to the launch of this new telescope. It's now named the Habitable Worlds Observatory in roughly like 2040 somewhere.
Given that like it's so technically challenging, I'm still quite impressed by the sheer number of exoplanets we have observed to this day. Given the limitations in our detection methods, I think there is about 35,000 exoplanets discovered. Does that sound about right?
So yeah, so there's a whole bunch that are discovered, and then there's two sort of accepted levels. They're candidates, and then there's like confirmed yeah. exoplanets. Because you're essentially there's a lot of assumptions that you get when you see the light dipping in front of a star, in front of a star.
Yeah.
That could be a planet, but it could also be like an artifact of the instrument. It could be like something in the system that happens. It could be the star that's misbehaving. So in terms of going from an exoplanet candidate to a confirmed exoplanet, you have to, for a transit at least, I think you have to see at least 2 transits, and you have to be able to predict sort of or understand the time difference between them, that it has to be like constant to a certain degree, right? So there's a couple of steps you need to do to go from a candidate to a confirmed exoplanet. So we have there's numbers like 5,500 or something that are confirmed. But those are all very much larger and very close in, like, or a lot of them anyways, because there's, again, the contrast ratio that you have to overcome to look at the star versus the planet, right? It's such a large number that you're much more likely to just to get very close in and hotter planets that just emits more light, they reflect more light, or they have a much stronger effect on their host star.
Hot Jupiters, basically.
Yeah, hot Jupiters are easy to find.
Yeah.
Or easier to find.
Could you quickly explain the different methods for detecting exoplanets?
Yeah, sure. So there's I was talking about this yesterday, and I tried to quantify it in essentially 3 different methods. There's a couple of other ways, but these ones are sort of the main workhorses of finding exoplanets. So transiting is what we talked about before, right? That is when a planet goes in front of the star, it blocks out a certain fraction of the light. You can follow that through time, and you see, you know, like a transit might take minutes, might take hours, but that is a very powerful technique because you get the size of the planet roughly, and you can even look at sort of the composition of the atmosphere by looking at the wavelength dependence of the transit. So if the if there's a lot of material in the atmosphere and it absorbs very strongly, the planet will look larger essentially. Whereas if there's no species in the atmosphere, the transit will be less deep essentially, so there will be less light blocked.
But this is quite limited to the orbital inclination of the plane around the star.
Correct.
Aligning with our line of sight.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So that is, so transiting is, it's in a way it's a bit of a low hanging fruit, right? And we can do a lot with it. But you're right. It's pure randomness what the alignment of the planetary system towards our observational angle is, right? So the estimates are that there's like probably only 1% of the planetary systems and stars that we look at might be aligned in such a way that we can see this. So we're missing a whole bunch of planets this way.
Is there a sort of bias for alignment of galaxies depending on which direction you look?
I don't think there has been any statistical difference between whether we're looking at a certain direction, what the chances are for alignment. It seems, as far as I understood, really totally random, or that's at least some of the assumptions that.
So there's no like galactical, alignment
no
there.
Definite plane.
That would be cool, right? Yeah. And then so if we want to go three methods. The second method is where we're looking at how much the star moves away from us and towards us as a function of the orbit of the planet. So because of the mass of the planet, essentially it's the star and the planet, they rotate around their central, like their shared central point of gravity, essentially. It's like a centrifuge, right? Like, and if you have a very heavy planet, it will move the star towards us and away from us by a tiny bit. And you can see that in the spectroscopy. So you get the Doppler effect, right? Like it's the ambulance that passes you, the sound, the pitch gets higher if the ambulance approaches, and the pitch gets lower once it removes from us.
The shift of frequency.
Yeah.
That's only visible via the Doppler effect.
Mostly, yeah.
So you can't actually see the star move at all, but it's just the Doppler effect.
There is another technique. They call it astrometry. So that's where they really pinpoint the position of the star very precisely. And I'll be honest, I don't fully understand that one very well, because it seems like the movement would be so small, right?
Yeah.
But there are ways to look at the actual physical displacement of the star as well.
But again, that will be highly limited to very close stars and very large planets orbiting around it, because you need the star to actually move and the center of mass to be outside the star itself, and which is really rare, I think.
Yeah, so that's a good point. It's hard to imagine that there are many planets where this is the case, right?
But this technique is also quite limited to the line of sight, given that we need the radial velocity of the star to be quite significant in order for us to detect a Doppler shift.
Right, and that leaves with a, and this is really interesting, because it leaves you with an uncertainty in sort of the plane at which the planet rotates towards us. Because if you have a very massive planet, and even if the orbit is very tilted, you would still get a significant amount of movement, so you can still see the Doppler shift. So instead of the mass of the planet, you get the mass multiplied by the sinus of the angle at which you're looking at the system. And then the third method, and this is a very powerful method for mostly for statistical presence of planets, and really like trying to get both of the methods that we're talking about, right? They're dependent on mass heavily and on size. So you're biased towards heavy and to very very massive planets. And then the third technique is a microlensing technique. So that's where a star essentially transits in front of another star. And the way that the mass of the star bends the light essentially causes a slight enhancement of the light of the star, the star that's being eclipsed essentially.
Yeah.
And if you look at that curve carefully, and there is a planet around the star that transits, the mass of the planet will cause an additional little enhancement in that stellar light, and that can give you information about relatively light planets, even like less mass than the Earth, which for Doppler shift is nearly impossible. And then finally, you can detect planets by looking at the direct reflected light, essentially. And there's definitely been some really cool videos where you can see people have been taking images of planets every so often, and you look at the reflected light. But then again, you have very big planets and typically very young systems, that they're very hot, so they emit a lot of light in the infrared, which is where you can look for these planets.
What's the population of exoplanets if you were to extrapolate what you know from the small subset of stars that you have in the galaxy? How many would you assume there are?
So some of the latest numbers that I've seen is that the expectation is that every star has at least one planet. So on average. So if you let that sort of sink in, right? Like out of unless like if we look at the solar system, right?
Yeah.
I think most of the techniques that we've been talking about would not be able to find any of our solar system planets. So we really only, we've only discovered like a small fraction of the planets that are out there, right? And if that already brings us to about one planet per star, I think it's not, you know, it's not unimaginable that there, that that planet, that that stars, all of them have at least several planets.
It could be a lot more.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Would you say that it is more typical for a single star system to have several planets and then there are several isolated stars, or would it on average be like one or two planets for each system?
I would guess, especially for stars that are there are essentially single stars, right? Because there's a lot of binary stars as well, or even like triple stars. The stability of systems like that is a little bit more complicated because like it's similar to like gravitational assist that that spacecraft sometimes do, right? Like if you have a very unstable system where the planets go around two or three stars, it's very likely that they might get kicked out of the system essentially by getting assist from one of the planets, and the system have to be stable over a very long time, of course, to really be able for us to be able to likely see it. So not considering like the triple stars or double stars, I would say most stars would definitely have at least as far as I understand like a series of planets. And I find that idea fascinating, right? Because you know there's a lot to be discovered out there.
Is it possible to make sort of an assumption of amounts of planet or sizes of planets based on the type of star?
I would say that's one of the long-standing problems in the field, because the planet formation theories, we always like, when you know, when I was in school and people explained this to me, it was like, oh, you know, we have material, we have a disk forming around the star, and the disk of this of material around the star, that's where the planets form, and that's why Jupiter is far out there, because it would be, you know, all of the material for, if the Earth or Jupiter would have formed around the Earth at the location of the Earth, everything would have been blown away. So we wouldn't, like, it's impossible. There's not that much material, right? Mm. But now we're seeing all these hot Jupiters, and that is very contrasting with that theory of planet formation. So the way that I understand it, I don't think we have a very good answer for how planets can form and how we have such massive planets so close to even little like small stars, right? That's another thing where we always thought, oh, you know, if you have a big planet or a big star, there's more material, so there will be larger planets around the star. But that's not necessarily the case either. We see very, very small stars with massive planets around that. So then, you know, it really challenges our understanding of planet formation, which I think it's fascinating, right? Like you observe something and that makes you go back to the drawing board. And we see the same thing with characterization of exoplanets, where we go, okay, you know, this was our model. This is how planets form. This is how planets evolve. And, you know, if it's this temperature, we likely have this. If it's that temperature, like have that. And then now we're getting all these observations back and we're like, well, this doesn't make sense anymore.
What do we do? Something's wrong with the theory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that is... I think for a while the field was kind of data starved, right? So it's really like, you know, if you, I'm a theoretician, so I can say this, but if you let theoreticians go wild for too long, you get all kinds of crazy ideas and everything everything's beautiful, everything works out great until like the real data shows up and they're like, well, back to the drawing board, right? But that's science, and I think that's a really cool part of science, you know, where you so James Webb has been operational for about a year and a half, right? And you can really see the field is sort of like struggling with the weight of all of the information that we're getting back, you know, and it's been really interesting because now we're like, I know a couple of people that have been studying like this transiting planets around M dwarfs, which are very small stars. So because the star is pretty small, the signals that you get from the planets are relatively larger. But now that we've been looking at these stars a little longer, we started to realize like these stars are not well behaved, you know, like the sun is very well behaved. Like it doesn't flare up with like intensities of 10% of its brightness over, thankfully, otherwise we wouldn't be here, right? But for these M dwarfs, they don't behave well at all, and you essentially like a significant part of the observations are essentially spoiled by the star misbehaving, because if you're trying to get the ratio between the amount of light that you get just looking at the star and then looking at the planet in front of the star, that ratio gets really screwed up if all of a sudden the star is like a couple of percent brighter, right? Because your planet signal might be in the percent or fractions of a percent, but if your star is all of a sudden so much brighter, you're in trouble, right? Because your ratio is just totally messed up.
Do you feel like this sort of when you're studying and working, do you feel often that you have assumptions that you made before or develop assumptions that you just realize are completely wrong?
Oh yeah. That's so my way of doing science essentially is like I try and really find a problem where I could like add, right? And the way that works is essentially you have to step over a whole lot of details, because if you're trying to understand the whole alphabet, you're not going to be able to contribute very well, right? So I skip over A, B, C, and D, and I sort of glance at it, I read it, I get a sort of background understanding of it, good enough to sort of like get to C in the alphabet and really understand that to a lot of detail, right? But then once you start like diving into that, you're like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. I need to go back and make sure that I understood that part right. And in a way, yeah, like you really have to divide it up and like make sure that you can get to the point where you can understand the like see in a lot of detail. But on that track, you start definitely noticing, okay, wait, this was a lot more complicated than I thought it was. And thankfully, I have colleagues then who are like, you know, that you're really missing something here. Like, this is something you can't make that assumption. You're like, okay, well, you know, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
What would you say are some of your major accomplishments in your work at NASA for the last 5 years? You have published any papers or made any discoveries you would like to brag about?
So the one thing I was really, really proud of, and I'm super happy with, is so we have this model, right? So we have this the planetary spectrum generator, and we use it to generate spectra from planets. But then our sort of our ultimate test, and I think now also our ultimate flex, essentially, is where we use all of the climate models of the Earth to reproduce images of the Earth. So Earth, of course, because it's observed so much, there's satellites that are at geostationary locations, so you can look at basically the same place, but you're looking at it from like from dawn to dusk, essentially. And we managed to reproduce the images of those to such a detail where one of my collaborators, and I don't think he did it on purpose, he was always like, okay, this is cool, these simulations, but which ones are the simulations and which ones are the images? And I was like, thank you for asking this question. Like, you don't have to do this every time, but you know, they're on the left. Those are the simulations. And it's really cool to be able to do that and really be able to cool. You know, we match the cloud patterns, we match the colors of the things we're looking at. And that is, yeah, I think that is super cool. Cause now we have this tool, and we, you know, like you told me I could brag, but if we can reproduce pictures of the Earth to this detail, right? Like, obviously it's not our tool that is limiting at that point, right? It's really, you know, like you can apply it anywhere now. It's like, we proved that it works. Now you can do it for whatever you want. Right. And I think that's definitely something I've been really proud of. Another thing is we did a whole bunch of work. So with the lab people, right. And this was, you know, sometimes in science, there was this my colleague, she came to me and she was like, hey, I want to do this. How do we do this? And I was like, okay, let me look into this. So I spent like a week and then we wrote a proposal and we were like, okay, let's send it out. Let's see what happens. Proposal got funded and we're like, oh, okay. Now we got to do the work, right? And then she got a postdoc, and this postdoc, super bright guy. And he came over and like, I was like, okay, he's working with this and this. And it's like, okay, cool. And then he spent 2 weeks and he's like, yeah, actually the thing that you wrote back there, that works. We have the results now. And ever since then, we've been working together, and we're really now getting like sort of the new data. Nobody's got them before. It's a little bit technical, but essentially if you have a high pressure atmosphere, like the atmosphere of Venus, and you're looking at absorption of CO2, there is a type of absorption that scales essentially linearly with the pressure. So the more molecules you add, the more absorption there is. And there is one type of absorption that starts only increasing above a certain pressure because it scales quadratically with the pressure. So it's the molecules essentially, they get disfigured by the pressure. And this disfiguring starts like adding absorption very strongly the deeper into the atmosphere you get. And because of like this super bright postdoc, and you know, we spend weeks in the lab trying to say, hey, I think this is a water line. Like there's some atmospheric water in your spectra. Can we figure out where that comes from? Because it overlaps with our data. I don't like, we can try and get it out, but I'm sure we can do better. So we did all kinds of things, you know, like you start out with duct tape and plastic bags, and then you we found out across the hall there was a guy that was very good at 3D printing, so he 3D printed some shielding for us essentially, so we could have a dry atmosphere in the spectrometer. And now we're really getting into details where, you know, people always assumed that it was, so this is called a pressure-induced absorption, that this pressure-induced absorption or collision-induced absorption was something that didn't change very much with temperature. But now that we have the data, we can really go back to the literature and be like, hey, guys, actually, it looks like there might be something that hasn't been accounted for just yet. And you start, because we have the methods so well down now, we can look at the temperature dependence and we go, oh, you know, actually, if you assume that this stays constant with temperature, you're wrong, because you're going to be overestimating a whole bunch of things.
Hmm. Working for NASA, I sure has some benefits, but like NASA, at least in Europe and practically globally, has like a gigantic reputation as being the first organization to put a man on the moon and sure. being in this organization. So I was wondering, like, what kind of bragging rights do you get personally for working at, like NASA do? Does it still have like this giant reputation as it did back in like the day?
Yeah, I think so. I feel like the manned missions were obviously like a phenomenal achievement, right? But the way that science is being done and the way that science is being funded, I feel it's just super impressive, you know, when you're walking around the building and you're like, hey, this is the engineering model of the Cassini mission. Like you have so what they do, you build a mission and they have like a test machine, right? And the test machine they keep in the lab to make sure that, oh, you know, if we turn it this way, it doesn't like, you know, it doesn't bug out, or, you know, the software doesn't do anything funky. But they just like, you know, you're not going to throw it out. So you just leave it around, you put it in a case and people can look at it. And the amount of science that's being done, and, you know, and the way that science is, it's like we're just at the forefront of science. That is phenomenal. You know, like my supervisor, for instance, he's been starting, he worked on the James Webb space missions for the last 15 years. And we were out on a work-related trip, and it was a Friday evening, and he was like, oh shit, I think the data is coming in from Europa. And he was like, I don't have access to my computer now. So he called one of our colleagues. He's like, can you get the data? Because I know that other people are going to be looking at this too. And it's just fascinating that, you know, people right across the office or people that I work with are like, oh, you know, like the data from that telescope, you know, like $10 billion have been invested in this. It's coming our way now because you told it how to point, how to use the instruments, how long to stare at this thing. And now you got to, of course, it's a lot of work afterwards, but it's, you know, I would say that's definitely a very, very privileged position to be in.
It sounds incredible.
I remember just like half a year ago when I started doing my master thesis and was introduced to the research group in astrophysics here at NTNU, mm-hmm. that one of the things that they brought up on the weekly meeting was, remember that the proposal deadline for James Webb Space Telescope is coming up, so finish up your reports. And I was like, are they allowing us to apply for using like this James Webb Space Telescope that like I admired the pictures for just 2-3 days ago, like, yep. and I have as a screensaver on my phone,
yep,
which was quite an amazing feeling. And I feel like we have hosted several events here at NTNU as the student organization Space NTNU, and one time we had a NASA representative come here and they were treated like a celebrity. It has like just this ginormous status here in Norway. And like there are several big space companies in Norway as well, but they paled in comparison with like the NASA in attention that they got. So I would say like working at NASA has like a huge reputation, at least in Europe.
Yeah. No, you noticed that in the US too. It's very, you know, and I'm not anything special, you know. I feel like I work hard for things, and when I get to a problem, I don't give up. You know, I never was good at math. I never was really good at physics. I have some intuitive understanding for chemistry, but it's not always right, you know. And there's not much special about the people that work there either. You know, there's people that are specialized. You know, they've been doing the same work for 15 years, and it's a tenacity, but it's also, you know, it's about like it's about having fun while you work, and it's good people, and you want to work with good people. And if you get a problem, you know, you keep working at it, and if you don't understand it, you ask questions. Like, there's really, I would say there's, in that sense, there's nothing too special about it, but it definitely like, it's those moments when you do talk to people on the outside, you're like, oh wow, yeah, what I'm doing is actually really cool. And I work with some high school students, and it feels very privileged to be in a position where you know that it makes, you can make such a big difference in someone's life if you just, you know, just reach out and like, we do a project together, you know. And it's like, okay, well, I read this paper, this is what I want to look at, this is how we would do it, and here's some code, like, let's see if we can work this out together. And this, like, the way that people, like, that my students light up when we do some work together, and one of the students, she visited, and like, the amount of energy that you get from showing people around and be like, oh, you know, this is where we do our work, this is our normal desk, and then, you know, like, here's where other people walk around in the one of the world's largest clean rooms to put together the next big telescope, and you're like, wow, that's, yeah, those are my colleagues, right?
Yeah.
And everyone contributes like a small part, right? But it's a big organization, and you know, I think I would say like the European Space Agency and Norwegian Space Agency, like, we all contribute, right? And we might not have the same budget as NASA does, but that doesn't mean that we're not doing the same things, right? And I feel like, in a way that, you know, NASA does great things, but its reputation is almost disproportionate to what I feel like what the European Space Agency and other yeah. National space agencies deserve. Because, you know, what detectors are flying on James Webb? Like, who builds those detectors, right? It's not all NASA, but it's always collaborations between different institutes. You know, it's the Max Planck Institute in Germany, it's ESRON in the Netherlands. So they're big collaborations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like there is so much to praise NASA for like its outreach program.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a famous astrophysicist in Norway, Erik Knut, sent like a letter to NASA when he was a little child, and he actually got a response when they didn't need to apply to like a Norwegian boy, but they did.
Sure. Yeah.
And it marked him, and now he's like a famous astrophysicist that does a podcast as we do.
Yep. No, that's awesome. And that's one of the, so NASA is, there is dedicated budget to make sure that outreach is being represented, right? And that outreach is being done. So down the hall, we have a group of five people that's their full-time job, just to know, like, if there are, if there's papers that we think are going to be interesting for them, we send them to them, and they're like, okay, well, let's make a press release about this. But they organize so many events to make sure that there is material available if you have an event. And I think that that's very powerful, right? Because it's very inspiring, right? And we need more people to study physics and to want to study astronomy. And it's, yes, it's hard, but it's not, I would say it's, don't let that stop you, you know? Like, I wasn't very good at it. The only reason that I made it is because I learned how to puzzle out things. It's, you know, everyone can do it. Just stick with it. You know, it's hard, but that's part of the fun.
Yeah.
Given that we actually have a NASA employee here, I wanted to put you on the spot and ask, when will the Artemis crew land on the moon?
My guess is going to be 26.
Okay. When will we first become
an
interplanetary species?
Interplanetary species? 2050.
2050.
These are just numbers. Yeah. Like, don't come find me if
wild
I'm off.
But that would mean that the first, most likely the first person to set foot on Mars is already born.
Yeah.
Which is quite strange to think about.
Yeah.
And what age do you think that, like, the first astronaut on Mars would be? Would they pick someone young or someone old or?
So I think in terms of like the amount of radiation that you might get exposed to, I think one of the thoughts is that it would make sense to send someone who is slightly older, so that's the people that are listening now. You know, that is by that time, that is our generation of people. You know, we're not gonna be able to retire when we're 65. We're gonna be sent out to Mars because, you know. Like,
so people around born in the 1990s, early 2000 would be like 60, 50 years old, probably around there.
Yep, I think that would be a good age. You know, like, if
yeah.
unfortunately, because of the amount of radiation that you would be exposed to, one of the worries is that like that develops all kinds of like undesirable things on and in your body. So the older you are, the less rapid those changes are. So yeah, you know, we're if you're listening, like don't give up on it.
Yeah,
we might be the ones.
To finish off, I have some quick fire questions that I would like you to answer. First, what is your favorite star?
That's the sun.
Okay.
Second favorite star.
That is, I don't have an answer for that. I don't even know.
What's your favorite planet?
Earth.
Same as everyone.
Yep, sorry.
What's your favorite star sign?
I like the Big Dipper because that's the only one I can find.
Nice.
Easy to find as well.
Yes.
Especially in Norway because it's so high up in the sky, so it's quite visible in Norway.
Yep.
What fact about the universe do you feel is more fiction than fact?
Oof. I always struggle with the like sort of the extrapolation of what happens to the future of the universe. And essentially, so I'm a chemist by training, right? So we work with a lot of people that do a lot of like sort of the deep cosmology things where they think about the origin of the universe and like the Big Bang and like how we might be the Big Crunch or the Great Expansion and all that. And I'm not like, I don't understand this, and this is like my ignorance. So I'm not going to attack them on it, but it seems almost more science fiction than science when you're talking about, oh, these are the first microseconds after the Big Bang, or this is what's going to happen after 150 billion years. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I mean, like, I struggle to understand what's happening in the Earth's atmosphere, but I'm glad that you can look that far into the future and extrapolate your models from that, you know?
I mean, yeah, the first instance after the Big Bang just sounds like pure magic.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
yeah. I think it wasn't meant for the human brain to comprehend these facts and sizes, right, and aspects of the universe. And one more question. If you had to leave Earth, would you rather live on the International Space Station in a hypothetical cloud city on Venus, a colony on Mars, or an underwater city on Europa?
Go for the underwater city on Europa. I think that would be fascinating. Safe as well compared to the other locations,
given the radiation protection.
Yep. Yeah. A kilometer of ice above me would be much better than being in the top the clouds of Venus.
But it would be pretty dark, though.
Yeah, that's true. We can work out the details.
Just install some lights.
Yeah. And if you could send up a satellite tomorrow, what would the functionality of that satellite be if you didn't have to think about like the limitation of technology or money, time, anything?
I would build a very large space telescope that would work in the optical, because I feel like the optical is where a lot of the really fascinating things are seen, essentially. It would work all the way from the optical to the infrared, so we can get molecular features as well. And you're saying there's no limit to the size. It's gonna be probably like 100 meters across.
Hmm. Yeah, 100 meters. Would you be able to fit that in Starship? Perhaps
there were no limitations, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking that it was probably a lot closer to reality than we first thought.
Okay,
maybe.
Yeah. Well, what about a constellation then? What if we get like a series of spacecraft that can fly in formation and? Essentially, make that large mirror size possible.
Hmm.
That's where we get all the photons. That's where we get like the spatial resolution to look in all the details. Can you imagine like what we could do, like if we could resolve like 100 meter structures on Jupiter or on the outer planets?
A lot of questions would be answered.
Yep, we'd get a lot of questions back too. So
I had one more question. Do you think there is life out there?
I think so. It's hard to imagine that there's no life outside of our solar system, right? Because if you look at, obviously there's Earth, but then people are wondering whether there was life on Mars. You know, there's as we were talking, like the icy moons, right? Like under the surface. Again, it's hard to imagine, and like finding it is a whole different question, right? But that's where life on the Earth started, right? Like, or part of it is one of the theories anyway. Like the hot underwater volcanoes. So if we're looking at our solar system and there's already like four, maybe five or six places where life could hypothetically be possible. It's just a matter of like, how do we find it, and will we ever be able to sort of prove it to a good level?
You think we'll be able to find it in sort of the human race's lifetime?
I think so. And this is where it gets really tricky, right? Because, you know, it's not about the person who might write the article. They might be convinced, but am I convinced, right? Or are we, because, you know, it's very easy when you're like, oh, you know, I found this, this, and this, and that, so that means that it should be life. And it's like, well, just because that is our understanding of what we know now, that doesn't mean that, you know, it's not a very elegant, very simple Occam's razor kind of solution, right? Yeah. It's like, just because you can't understand it or can't explain it, it doesn't mean that it's life, right?
Yeah.
So I think proving it will be very difficult. But you know, it will be a gradual process where you're like, okay, well, we found something. People are going to get super enthusiastic. We're going to do a follow-up observation. We're going to follow-up observation. And it might take 20 years because we need to build a telescope that can actually be able to answer the questions that we want to be able to, or need to have to answer to constrain this. But I think it'll be a gradual process, and it'll be, I wonder what it would do to society. You know, like, it's, if there is life on other planets, like how does that fit in with our understanding of ourselves? And
yeah,
maybe also like sort of the fragility of our atmosphere and our own lives, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting, but also kind of scary.
I think so, yeah.
But unfortunately, that's all we had for today. Thank you so much, Vincent, for coming.
Thank you guys for having me. This has been really fun.
Yeah, it has been a true pleasure. And we could speak on this for hours and hours and hours.
Come back later.
Yeah, sure. No, thank you guys so much.
If you want to hear more of this podcast, you can find us on your preferred podcast platform. This is the first episode in English, but if it's well received, we'll make more in the future. You can find more about us on social media at Space Antenu and on our website, spacesantenu.no. This is it for now. Thanks for listening, and have a nice day.